We made this.
Welcome, everybody, to a crossover between the Movie Palace and the Motion Pictures Podcast. My name is Carl Sweeney, and I'm joined by a man who is, I think it's fair to say, my brother from another mother, Mr. Tony Black. How are you doing, Tony?
I'm all right, mate. Yeah, I heartily agree there. I definitely think there's some, you know, film-based DNA going on between you and I.
Yeah. Let's hope so. So in this episode, we are here. It's a crossover episode, like I say. We'll discuss that a bit in a sec. But we're primarily discussing Ben Wheatley's new adaptation of the Daphne du Maurier story, Rebecca. I think we're also going to touch on the book itself, which I think Tony has read, and the Alfred Hitchcock 1940 version, but mainly the Ben Wheatley version, which is new. It's on Netflix. But Tony, like I said, this is a crossover with the Motion Pictures Podcast. Should we tell people what that podcast is, what we do on that podcast, or what we do on Motion Pictures?
Yeah, I'd say if anyone hasn't listened to it, and, you know, given you've got a lot of fans for the Movie Palace, quite a few of you guys might well be crossing over. But if you're not, it is more of a general show, I guess. I mean, the Movie Palace obviously is focusing primarily on, you know, golden era Hollywood with certain, like, tangents here and there, like today's, I guess, really. But with Motion Pictures, we're sort of covering new material, old material, and kind of topics. We sort of base it around a topic more than just a review of a movie, I suppose. So we'll take a new movie, like our most recent one before this was the Borat 2 movie, subsequent movie film. And then we talked about the broader reality of comedy and how it sort of works around Borat for that. So that's kind of the focus, really. And I think it's pretty fun. We get to be quite varied, don't we, and go in depth on quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah, we do, because I think although we normally tether it around something that's new or topical, the way we approach it means we can go all the way back to, you know, all these historical reference points and things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we've had some nice varied discussions on there, haven't we, I think? Yeah. So we've done about how many? It's like 16 episodes or something like that, is it, so far?
Yeah, I think this might be 17 or 18, one of the two. Yeah, something like that. So not too bad. Yeah.
So we're building up a bit of a back catalogue. So we thought, I just think because this film is new, because you can't escape the comparisons with the Hitchcock film, we thought this would be a neat crossover to do with Movie Palace and Motion Pictures. So hopefully that's the case.
Yeah.
So where can people find Motion Pictures online if they do want to, you know, track it down after they listen to this?
So I guess there's three main places. If on Twitter, there is Motion Picks Pod, if you're on Twitter. And on Facebook, we've got a Facebook page just called Motion Pictures Podcast. But there's also our Facebook group, Motion Pictures Film Club, which is quite a nice little group with about 100 or so members talking about movies. And there's some good discussions in there. So I'd encourage anyone to get in there if you're on either of those platforms. Or obviously, you can find our episodes at wemadethispod.com as well. So that's roughly where we are.
Yeah, I definitely encourage anybody listening to join the Facebook group if they would like to do that, because, you know, it'd be nice to have some classic film discussions on there too. Mm. Anything, really. We're happy for anything that people want to talk about. So, I would echo that. All right, Tony, with all that said, let's turn our thoughts to Rebecca. Okay, I think the first thing I would like to mention, Tony, is that on the topic of Rebecca, I actually recorded a Movie Palace episode on the 1940 film some time ago with the fantastic Gabriella Masson, which I really enjoyed.
I should listen to that. Oh, I'm gutted. I should have remembered. I remember that now you've said it.
Yeah, no, she. I believe it's her favourite book, or one of her favourites, certainly, and we had a really good time talking about that.
Yeah.
I actually aired it as a rerun again this year on the Movie Palace, I think, when I was priming people for the Psycho episodes. So if people look down the feed, you should see Rebecca at least once. I think it's on there twice. So I'll flag that up for people. I think I've talked at length about, obviously, the Hitchcock film in there. Now, the thing I admire about you, Tony, is you always like to give podcast listeners value for money. So
I don't even know what to say to that. But yeah, cool. Okay.
So you could have just strolled up and just watched the 2020 version, but you thought you were, you know, put the time in, which I really appreciate, to be fair, because you've read the du Maurier story, which is, you know, it's not short necessarily. You've put the time in and you've watched the Hitchcock film. So fascinatingly, I don't really know much of what you think about any of these things, except the book, which I know you enjoyed the book because you tweeted something about, you'd read it for the first time and you liked it. And I think you also said it didn't go where you thought it would go. So I was just kind of wondering what that means. Tell us about what you thought of the book.
I thought the book was really good in the sense that Daphne du Maurier's writing is very involving, and she draws you into the psychodrama of Rebecca in a very, very quickly and in a really interesting way. And I think the book generally surprised me in that I'd always assumed, and because this is the first Daphne du Maurier book I've ever read, I'll be clear about that. But the other film adaptation I've seen of one of her works was Don't Look Now, the Nicholas Roeg film, which I'm a huge fan of. And that obviously is a supernatural kind of chiller, very sort of low key in that sense, but it is a bit supernatural. So I always assumed that Rebecca was an actual ghost story. You know, I really did. I thought that this was a bit of a haunted house kind of thing. You had this whole old house and Rebecca was stalking the corridors. And I really did think that was it. I didn't really know it was much more of a psychological drama about obsession and about, well, all kinds of things to do with marriage and love and loneliness and loss, yep. a real range of stuff. And so that in itself surprised me once I realised what the book was doing and that it was from the viewpoint of the unnamed second Mrs. De Winter. And where, in terms of where it went, I assumed, I'm guessing we're in spoiler territory here.
Massive spoilers for the book, the Hitchcock film and the 2020 film. Yeah, maybe ahead.
I'd say to anyone, if you don't want to know, go away, read the book, watch the films, come back. But if you've done that, great. By the end, I assumed that we would find out that Rebecca was either alive or that, you know, or that something, that there was a plot in place. I didn't think it was going to be that he killed her in the book, Maxim. And that then she puts together this plot of this seeming plot of, you know, pretending she's pregnant when she's actually dying and all this kind of thing. And so I think when we got to that point in the book, I was like, I didn't think this is where it would go. So I quite liked that. I quite liked the fact it twisted. And I think the thing about Rebecca, and like I say, I haven't listened to the Movie Palace episode on Rebecca, and I will do after this. I wish I had, because I'd be interested to see what you'd said about it before in terms of that movie. But what I thought was great about the book is that you don't really know if any of this is accurate, because it's all from the perspective of the second Mrs. De Winter, and it's going through her prism from a distance. You know, the very first line is, I dreamt I was at Manderley. So she's talking about this in the future. So she's recalling events. So there's the unreliable narrator trope, for one thing, but there's also the fact that you don't ever really know quite who Rebecca was. You only have second-hand things to go on. You only have what Max says she was like. And it contradicts in many ways what a lot of other people thought of her, particularly the character of Mrs. Danvers, who is quote-unquote the villain of the piece, if you like, although it's not quite that simple. So I loved that. I loved the nature of that, in that you don't really quite know what the truth is, even by the end of this story. But you've had this fantastic exploration of this woman's psychology and how it fits in this very sort of Edwardian aristocratic sort of 30s world, which is vividly drawn by du Maurier. So I really, really liked the book, and I barreled through it fairly quickly. I was then very keen to see the movies afterwards and see how they compared.
Yeah, it's a really great book. And like I said, I've talked about it a bit more length in that earlier podcast, but I pulled it out again earlier this week just wanted to refresh myself, really, read a few chapters and get re-familiarized. But I ended up, I've read about 300 pages over the last couple of days, because it does pull you in. I haven't finished it again.
It does.
Yet, but
yeah.
Yeah, really great storytelling for the reasons you've outlined, I think. I had wondered if you were thinking about it along the lines of a ghost story. I wondered if that's what you meant when you said it didn't go where you thought it would. Because I suppose she's not a presence haunting the book as a ghost, but she's like, the idea of Rebecca is haunting the story though, isn't it? I think that's what's good about it.
It is a ghost story in that sense, in a way. And I think in the new film, Mrs. Hopper even says, you know, he doesn't want to live there on his own with a ghost, you know? So that's a bit more on the nose, I suppose. But yeah, it is... it is a ghost story in a way. It's just a different one.
Yeah, making things literal in the new adaptation.
Yeah.
Um, In terms of, you said about Du Maurier film adaptations, you've seen The Birds, haven't you? That's another Du Maurier tale.
I have. I completely forgot it was her, though, actually. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Have you read the book of The Birds?
No, I haven't. I haven't read it. I think it might be a short story. I think that one is supposed to be quite different to what Hitchcock did. Okay, what about the 1940 Rebecca then? Of course, the Hitchcock version, I believe his first film in America, the only Hitchcock film to win Best Picture. How well did he translate what the book does, which you've just described, into cinematic terms? Did you enjoy it?
I did, but...
yeah.
And I can't quite believe I'm saying a but about a Hitchcock film, particularly, actually, one that, having read up on this and read a bit in the backstory of it and things like this, and... You know, it's critically acclaimed. It's like 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody thinks it's a masterpiece. I didn't. And I don't think it's necessarily one of his best films. And I'll try and explain why. I did enjoy it. But I felt like, and to be honest, this is a similar problem, not to get too much ahead of myself, but this is a similar problem I had with the Ben Wheatley film. In that I think this book, by very definition of the way it is written, is very, very difficult to translate onto screen, simply for the fact that it is such an interior piece of work about the psychology of Mrs. De Winter, that trying to really convey the central sort of emotion that she feels and about how she relates to this story, which is the key, which is the core aspect really of both movies, I think is extremely difficult to do. And I don't know if either film really pulls it off, to be honest, because in the 40s film, everything is extremely faithful to the book. And I believe that was one of the preconditions of David Selznick, the producer, who Hitchcock wanted to go a bit more off-piste, didn't he? But Selznick was like, no, we're making the book completely. In that sense, I admire it for the fact it does stick to the story and it sticks to the book, except for the change at the end about Max not being the killer because of the production code, which takes the teeth out of it, doesn't it, really? But... and the fact that Danvers dies in the fire as well, which doesn't happen in the book, it seems. But I just felt like, on a technical basis, it looked fantastic. It had a real sense of gothic atmosphere. The performances are good. I think Olivier is very brittle and stark as Max. And to be honest, I'm going to probably cause some controversy in the fact that I think that the acting in the new version is much better. And I think they're far better cast. Yeah,
no way.
I do.
No way.
I do.
No way.
I am good at, I don't expect people to agree with me on that one, but I do. I really do. I think Armie Hammer is a much better Max De Winter, personally.
I'm shocked.
Well, I know, because I'm basically saying someone's better than Olivier, and I can't quite believe I'm saying that, but I did. I do, and I will get to that. And he's very good, don't get me wrong, but I didn't really ever feel that relationship, and I felt it a bit more with the new one, to be honest. But... and I think Joan Fontaine was perfectly good. But again, I think it goes back to the fact, I don't know if you can really put this across. I don't know. In the book, there's so many instances of Mrs. De Winter trying to sort of second guess everybody. You know, she's constantly assuming what people are thinking. She's playing scenarios out in her head. She's wondering about this. She's fantasizing about that. And Hitchcock is telling the story as a very, you know, a very traditional sort of gothic. I think he's called it a bit like sort of Bronte. He sort of said it's a bit of a Bronte version of a kind of story, and there's a very Victorian aspect to the way it's all presented. And that comes across great. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that in any sense. And I thought it was all... I thought Franz Waxman's score laid it on a bit thick at times. I particularly the sequence where Mrs. De Winter comes down in the dress and she completely gets it wrong. The music doesn't work there. The music's weirdly sort of romantic and flighty and that kind of thing. I was like, this needs menace. And I think one of the things the film didn't have for me was menace. I didn't really necessarily feel the oppressive menace of it in the same way as I did the book. So I admire a lot of what it was doing. I think it's obviously it's very well made because it's Hitchcock, but I didn't really love it, if I'm honest. So... But I do think it's better than the new one. I will say that. I do think it's a better film, but I do think there are things in the new one that I do like more, actually. So
interesting.
I apologise to all classic cinema fans.
No, you don't need to apologise for your awful opinions. It's fine. I think a few people like you. I think a few people have quibbled with Olivier over the... I can't remember now who it was, but I remember reading one critic when I was researching the last episode I did and on this, and it talked about his kind of charmless performance and things. So there are people who've said similar. I think of Rebecca as being, I've watched it again fairly recently, I think of it as being a second tier Hitchcock, which is obviously still very good.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't put it up there as one of his absolute ironclad masterpieces, because I think, for me mainly, it's the final third of the film is a bit less interesting. It loses some of that interiority because I think it seems like the second Mrs. De Winter's on the sidelines quite a bit, you know, when it becomes a bit more procedural.
Mm. And in the book as well, she's sidelined from certain things, but it's always about her. So in the book, even though she's not necessarily going to see the doctor, and that's, you know, Max and Frank or whoever, you're still seeing it from her perspective. You're still in her mind. You're still seeing, whereas the film can't do that. The film struggles because it's telling the story so faithfully in a way. I agree. It sort of takes the focus away. So
So I really think the second act at Manderley in the Hitchcock film is great. I think the way he builds the claustrophobia through there is really effective. And I really like Joan Fontaine's performance. I think I get nervous just thinking about it because she's so, she sustains it really well. I just think of her kind of wringing her hands, you know, and this kind of mousy presence. So I like what the film does with her. I think we'll come back to this because we'll compare at certain points when we talk about the new film. But as you point out, the film is constrained in certain ways. And I think, the change about Rebecca's death, as much as they had to do it, I don't think it's as convincing as in the story. Of course, Max and De Winter could be lying or whatever. But still. Now, I think what's worth pointing out before we come to Ben Wheatley is that, of course, there have been lots of adaptations of Rebecca as well, on stage, on TV and radio. I think there's a miniseries with Diana Rigg as Mrs. Danvers. I'd like to see at some point. Oh, Judith Anderson, Mrs. Danvers, is great in Hitchcock, I should say.
She is. Shall I tell you where I know her from, though, mainly?
Go on.
Judith Anderson, right. this is such a Tony reference, but I know her from the Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
Okay.
Right, because at the very end, she plays, this is towards the end of her career, to be fair, so she's quite old by this point, but she plays a high Vulcan priestess who helps bring Spock to life with like a magical incantation. And she's really good. She's only in it for like 5 minutes. She's really good, actually. So, yeah, I know her from that.
Nice.
But she is good. I agree. She is good as Danvers, yeah.
Yeah, lots of fun. How is it that everything comes back to Star Trek somehow with you?
You'd be amazed, Carl. Yeah. Everything is, you know, that degrees of separation thing?
Yeah.
You can get to Star Trek, I'm convinced, with about two or three paces from anything. I bet you.
Yeah, no, I believe you. the other interesting thing with Danvers, have you seen the Wallace and Gromit film? I think it's The Wrong Trousers with the penguin.
Oh, maybe. A while ago. I can't quite remember.
I think Nick Parker said the penguin in that film is inspired by Danvers. It's this kind of menacing presence. Yeah. So people should check that
very
out.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've had all these other takes on the story. And now Ben Wheatley has adapted the book again, and it's on Netflix. It went to cinemas quickly, and now it's on Netflix. Mm. So I don't know if you're a Wheatley fan especially. Did you want to give people a bit of a heads up on who he is and whether this is like a natural fit for him? Because I don't know if people will think it is.
I don't know if it is. I was thinking that, actually. He's a British director. He's been around for just over 10 years, I think, something like that. And he started making very kind of low-budget-ish, kind of, I'd say, cult British horror sort of thriller movies. Things like Kill List, which is a fantastic, horrible movie.
that film is messed up.
It's messed up. It's like The Wicker Man meets an episode of The Bill, right? It's proper. It's proper nasty. But it's very good. And stuff like Sightseers with Alice Lowe, which is just really twisted as well. A darkly comic, that kind of stuff. In recent years, he's kind of become a bit more mainstream. You know, he directed a few episodes of Doctor Who when Peter Capaldi came back. He's done stuff like High Rise, which I think is his pinnacle, to be honest. I think that's a fantastic adaptation of the J.G. Ballard film. He actually does float around quite a few different genres. He did, one I liked recently was Happy New Year, Colin Burstead, which was much more of a sort of a family drama set at New Year, again, Blackley comic. So he's kind of, he's sort of along those lines, really. But I don't, I was a bit surprised that he was doing Rebecca, because it's a very traditional British, or sort of a little bit, I suppose it's a little bit Anglo-American, really, Rebecca, in a way. You know, it's got that, even though it's written by a British writer in, like, well, Du Maurier wrote it both in, like, Cairo, I think, and Cornwall. You know, she wrote it sort of in between places. But it does sort of have an exotic old Hollywood sort of feel to it, you know, as a story, I think, particularly when it's, you know, filmed. So, yeah, it's a bit, in a way, left field for Wheatley. I expect Wheatley to be a little bit more edgy and messed up. I mean, yeah. Do you think that as well?
Yeah, this is not necessarily something I would have associated him with before it was announced. You know, because it's maybe even a bit more, he has taken a mainstream turn, but maybe this is even more so. But then he seems to be going through that kind of phase, because he's attached to direct Tomb Raider 2 and the Meg 2. Did you know that?
What, really?
Yeah.
The Meg 2? No way.
That was announced last week, yeah.
No, that's mad.
Which you just, like you say, I was really intrigued when it was announced that he was doing Rebecca, because I really like Kill List and I really like Sightseers. Yeah. And I thought, okay, this guy, he's going to end up doing something really twisted with Rebecca.
Yeah.
And then I never saw the trailer for this film. I saw some publicity photos which were being ripped apart on social media. Mm. I think that people just felt it was too bright and sunny, you know, and not sure about the casting and that kind of thing. I was like, well, let's wait and see. I think I had faith he would take this material and do some really interesting things with it, you know. Mm. I'll tell you what he said about, I think he was asked, like, why adapt Hitchcock? And he said, for me, the project is clearly an adaptation of the book. It wasn't a remake of the film. That was unattractive to me. Why would you want to remake a Hitchcock film and won so many Oscars? But in the end, you can't help but make stuff in a postmodern way where other movies will help define it. Your relationship to the script and the actors' performances is the thing that makes the film, not thinking about something older which has been made. So even before we think about this film then, like, do you think just from the get-go he was on a bit of a hiding to nothing, that obviously these comparisons were going to loom large, whatever he did?
Well, as he learned nothing from Gus Van Sant, you know, that's the thing. I don't know. I think maybe. I mean, the thing is, outside of, like, film fans and film buffs, would many people really have remembered that Hitchcock directed Rebecca? You know, I mean, is it one of those films? I mean, if you said to a random person, name a Alfred Hitchcock film, they might go Psycho. They probably almost certainly would say Psycho first and foremost. They might say Vertigo, maybe. Something like that. I think they would name more of The Birds. I think they'd name much more of his later American movies. I know this was his first one, but this is 1940. This is 80 years ago. I don't know if Rebecca necessarily is at the forefront of people's minds. So I don't know really if a lot of people would have gone into this thinking, oh, he's just going to rip off Hitchcock. But at the same time, there are going to be a fair few people who know about movies and love Hitchcock who are going to be constantly looking to see and compare. I kind of think it's a bit unfair, though, because I do believe him when he says that he's going after the book, because I do think that he doesn't just try and, you know, Xerox Hitchcock in this film. I don't, and I watched them pretty close together. So I, you know, the 1940 film is quite fresh in my mind. And I don't think it is fair to say that he did. I think both Hitchcock, and as I say earlier, that wasn't Hitchcock's choice. Hitchcock would have apparently done something very different. But both Hitchcock and Wheatley are very faithful to the book, but they do it in slightly different ways, I think.
I think you make a good point. I think that considering that this was going to Netflix and that, you know, I don't think there are a lot of Alfred Hitchcock films on Netflix. I think Vertigo's on Netflix in the UK, but you're not going to be able to go on there and go through his whole back catalogue.
No. You're not going to get Juno and the Paycock on there, are you?
No, not yet. I think a lot of the people who will end up watching this film are people who haven't seen a 1940 film and, you know, may not have the familiarity with the book and just may have heard the name, you know, may have heard about it, but don't really know what it's about and so on.
Mm.
I think he was always going to draw these comparisons in, like, reviews. And I think from that kind of the classic film fandom, you know, which I'm part of and I know a lot of people who are, who revere this film, I think those people are always going to make these comparisons. But I think I'm not one to say you can't remake certain films or you should never readapt stories and things. I think it's fine. However, let's talk about how well he did it. I think that's the question. So I've seen the film twice now. I watched it on the day it came out, and then I thought last night, well, okay, let's give it another go. On the first watch, I thought, okay, this is all right. I didn't think it was much more than all right. I couldn't really understand why he had wanted to make this version of Rebecca in the sense that it wasn't as radical a departure from the source text as I had imagined him making. I think there are hints of it, but it's not really sustained. And then we'll talk about this. So, some of the changes he has made don't seem all that wise to me. And we'll get into this. But anyway, as I said, I thought I'll give it another go. And last night I liked it a bit more second time round. I think there are some nice stylistic things going on here. Maybe not as attention grabbing as I'd have imagined or as I would have liked. So there's some interesting like elliptical editing, which fits with like the dream stuff that's going on. It's all, you know, the second Mrs. De Winter's dream, isn't it? There are some distinctive soundtrack choices, aren't there? So we got like the Pentangle song, the folk song, Let No Man Steal Your Time, which kind of, yeah, I like that. I thought it was good.
Mm.
Occasionally it goes a bit more out there with the imagery, you know, things like the second Mrs. De Winter being pulled under by vines and that kind of thing. Mm. So there are some of things, aren't there, here, which mark it out as a very different cinematic Rebecca. The issues I had, which is interesting because it's diametrically opposed to what you're saying, I think, I had some issues with the cast and with some of the story choices. So I think it's perfectly watchable. I'd give it a qualified recommendation. But just as Rebecca's this like palpable absence through the story, I always had the feeling that maybe there's something missing here.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I think I honestly truly believe that if you're adapting Rebecca as a faithful take on that source material, I don't really know that you're going to get a better visual representation than this, to be honest. I think this is, and I'm not necessarily saying that that means it's an expertly put together film. I'm just saying in terms of how it looks, in terms of the style of it, in terms of capturing maybe what de Maurier is going for in a very sort of visual modern aesthetic, I think that is probably pretty good overall. The problem, and like I say, I think Armie Hammer and Lily James are spot on casting personally. I think Kristin Scott Thomas is terrific casting for Mrs. Danvers. I think pretty much they got all of that right for me. And I could see them, having read the book, I could see them in those parts. My issue was that I didn't feel much of anything all the way through.
Mm.
I think my wife made a comment about how she felt that the love story was better between Max and Mrs. De Winter in this film than in the 40s film, which she also watched with me. And I think I agree to an extent, but I think the problem is that you can't almost compare the two in a way because they're 100 years separated nearly in terms of when they were put together. So the ideas of what a romantic love affair would be then and now are extremely different. So I don't necessarily think that that is any worse. It's just a different approach that fits the era. In this, obviously, there is a bit more sex. There is a bit more, you know, in the moment, sort of melodramatic passion. Lily James gives much more of an expressionistic kind of performance, you know, in that sense. But I didn't really care about any of it, and I was visually impressed by it. I understood what it was trying to do. I think it had some interesting visual things. I think it was faithful while still managing to, you know, change certain aspects, sometimes for the better, sometimes not. I think it nailed certain things that the other film didn't. I think the whole, like I mentioned, the whole her coming down the staircase in the dress, I think that was much better. That was much more, for me, in line with what the book was. And I thought, yeah, they've got that right there. That works. But I came at the end of it thinking I should have been rocked by that film. I should have been haunted by it. I should have been quite drained from the psychology of it. But again, it can't convey the interior nature of it in the way that I think is in de Maurier's writing. And I think it's an eternal problem with adapting Rebecca, for one thing, anyway, as I say. But I also think that it's not as passionate or as thrilling or as weird or as tense or as scary as it should have been. It was kind of on a neutral level all the way through for me.
That's very interesting. So let's talk about the relationship then, because you point to the fact that it plays out much more as a romance than in the earlier film, doesn't it? Because it's not that romantic, really, in the 1940 version. There's much more of a physical dimension to it, isn't it? They kiss on the sand. I think at one point when they're back at Manderley, I think they play footsie, don't they? And we see them in bed together. Yeah. I think it was separate beds before. Yeah. Just generally a bit more tactile. So I think what Wheatley has said is that the idea is that by the time we get to Manderley, it's like the house is a bromide that destroys sex. So I think you're right. I think there's that kind of neutral thing going on where he could have leaned into this side of things more. So he could have made those early scenes really sexual if the intent is for that to be like drained away afterwards. Instead, it's all a bit kind of bright and glossy for my liking. Or he could have gone the other way and made it like really restrained, you know, and do everything through suggestion which I think would maybe accord quite well with the original story. But we end up with something in the middle, don't we? Because it's like a rom-com kind of meet-cute where they, you know, where they meet. And there's some weird stuff. Like there's a moment where Lily James is looking at her shoulder in the mirror. It's like a bit weird. And
yeah, it's more, I mean, it's appealing, I suppose, to the mass audience who are going to want to see, you know, these two extremely attractive people hook up, you know. I mean, you know, they are kind of at the peak of their beauty, these two. Yeah, and they're pretty classically gorgeous people, both of them. So in that sense, you're going to, you know, your audiences are going to want them to, they're going to want, I mean, who is this film appealing to? You know, that's the thing in terms of the remake.
Yeah.
You know, who is it for? Is it for a female audience? Is it for, you know, people who get a proper thirst trap for all this stuff, you know, between Armie Hammer and Lily James? I'd argue it probably is a little bit, which is strange for Ben Wheatley, because I would expect from Ben Wheatley something that far more psychologically mad and intense and weird. And I think the closest he gets to that is through Kristin Scott Thomas's performance. I think she brings... I think Judith Anderson, as I say, was really good as that really cold, icy Danvers who was just, you know, full on sort of intense. But I think there's a twisted playfulness to Scott Thomas's performance in this that I really liked. And I think there's hints of that there, but you don't really get it with Armie Hammer and Lily James. They are playing, like you say, a bit of a romantic comedy drama in a way.
Yeah.
Not a comedy in the sense of, you know, laugh out loud. There's nothing funny in this, essentially. But you know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah.
And I think that is much more of a traditional approach that, you know, obviously is very different from the 40s film, but probably would have been different from if you'd have made this 30 years ago, you know? And I don't know. It never really got out of first gear. I think they had chemistry to an extent, but it wasn't true. I didn't feel the true passion. I didn't feel the, like, I don't know. Well, to use Don't Look Now, I didn't feel the Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie stuff in that film, which is proper off the screen, red hot. Jesus Christ, that is just... I need a shower now after this, a cold shower. Whereas with this, you don't really get that. No. You know?
Okay, let me get into my problems with this film then. So, Armie Hammer has talked about how... Well, the thing is that there's a big age gap in the book between Maxim and the second Mrs. De Winter. She's like half his age, basically. There's about a 10-year difference between Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier, but I think Olivier looks older and she looks younger, so it's significant there too. And here, there's not much in it. Lily James is a couple of years, 2 or 3 years younger than him. And Armie Hammer said, if there was a 20-year age gap and a guy treated his new wife the way Maxim treats his, it would just make the modern audience uncomfortable, as it should. And I also heard Ben Wheatley being interviewed about this by Simon Mayo, and he was saying that he felt the older man, younger woman relationship pattern is overly familiar and that you can achieve that power imbalance through other ways. So for me, though, this is quite a big problem with the film because I think it's an integral characteristic of the Maurier story. I was struck on rereading it this week by just how many references there are to the age gap and, you know, how it makes things play out because it contributes to how out of place she feels at Manderley and this big gulf between her and her husband. So I can kind of see what Ben Wheatley's talking about in a broader sense. You know, it's fair to say that the older man, younger woman thing is overused in mainstream cinema. But for one thing, there's nothing inherently wrong with older men and younger women getting together. Lots of people do and have happy relationships doing so. And that's fine as long as everybody's happy, as long as, you know, it's all good. And the thing is that Rebecca is not really an unthinking utilization of that trope. Quite the opposite. It's all about that, I think, in a lot of ways. So... It sounds to me like Wheatley, and it may, I don't know, maybe his collaborators, maybe this is a working title thing and they wanted certain people in the cast, I'm not really sure. It's a good thing. They've kind of internalized the logic of equality in some ways, but I think they've added two and two together and got five, you know.
I can see what you mean. I do agree, actually. As much as I think Armie Hammer is a really good Max, I do think maybe he would have been a perfect Max if he was 10 years older, you know, and playing that role, maybe. You know, I think you're right, actually. I think the age gap is an issue because they feel much more contemporaries. They feel much more like, you know, they could have met in a club or they could have met on, you know, a posh dating site, you know, as opposed to just, you know, because in the book, you really do get the feeling that, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of like an appropriate sort of actor who's in his mid to late 40s. Okay. Say Daniel Craig had played this role. Okay.
Yeah.
And with Lily James, or even someone even a bit younger than Lily James. I don't know. Somebody up and coming in terms of, you know, who's about 20, something like that. Imagine that. Imagine how that would have come across. Like, because let's face it, Daniel Craig is playing James Bond. He's 52 now, something like that. You know, there's a good chance he's probably going to sleep with a woman in that film. I mean, Lea Seydoux is like, what, 30s? Yeah. Like, in that film, he's sleeping with Madeline, and she's at least 20 years younger than him. And that film won't make anything of that. It never makes the fact that Bond's older than her. They're just, you know... So you could have absolutely had... In fact, Daniel Craig would have been a really good casting for this, I think. You could have had Daniel Craig play this role, someone like that, and had him with a younger... And it would have been had more of an impact, I think, definitely. Because, like you say, the whole point in the book is that Max has lived... He's had this relationship. He's had this wife. Mrs. De Winter's not. You know, she's this young ingenue in many ways. She's completely starts the novel under the thrall of Mrs. Van Hopper, who's a horrendous, loathsome human being. And she knows this, Mrs. De Winter, to be. She knows this, but she doesn't know anything else. And it's only then, through going to Manderley, through getting involved in all this, that she starts to change and she starts to, you know... And she's haunted and trapped by the psychological spectre of Rebecca and how perfect Rebecca seemed to be and how loved she was and how amazing she was. And this film doesn't do that. It doesn't. You don't really get that sense. You know, it tells you that Rebecca was perfect. It tells you that she feels, you know, oppressed and trapped by the spirit of Rebecca. But you don't feel that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. And that's. I didn't feel that in either of these films. I won't lie. I didn't feel it in either one of them. And I think I'm waiting for that adaptation that does make me feel that, to be fair.
I think part of me on Maxim, I think I'm just fundamentally a bit unconvinced about the idea of making him a bit of a hunk, you know, like the scene here where he's carrying her into Manderley in the rain and stuff. And like I said, some people have criticized Olivier's incarnation of the character, I think. But I think Olivier was like really brooding and tempestuous. I can believe he's kind of this haunted man. But Armie Hammer, who I've liked in some other stuff, I just thought he was a bit lost here because I didn't think he's that good at conveying a sense of somebody who has a secret, you know. When he does lose his rag, he just comes across to me as a bit sulky. So, like, rather than being tempestuous. And there are other moments, like when she asks him about his sleepwalking, he just seems like a bit like a deer caught in headlights. And I think some of it's not his fault, though. I think a lot of it comes back to the age thing because I think it's when he says lines like... I haven't enjoyed myself like that for quite a long time, or years ago on my honeymoon. I'm kind of thinking, really? Because the thing is that even if he's the same age as Olivier, like I said, Olivier looked a bit older, but men were different then. Men aged different then. And I think if you think about people like us who are like these big overgrown man children, we have these like extended adolescences, don't we? So
yeah.
I think maybe it all kind of loops back to the age issue because I think the film, maybe it's not thorough enough reimagining to kind of fully wash that away. I don't know.
Yeah, you might be right, actually. I think you're starting to turn me on this now, actually. I just think you're starting to make me rethink. Particularly, I still stand by Lily James, I think, being very good in this role, to be fair, given what she's got. But yeah, maybe you're right about Armie Hammer. I definitely think you're right about the age. I think that is a key aspect, really, because... You know, the story in the book works precisely because of her naivety and her innocence, you know, and the fact that she is in various ways sort of trapped and manipulated or completely sort of clueless about the mind of all these people. You know, in the book, she constantly spends all of her time projecting what other people are thinking, particularly Max. You know, what is he thinking? What is he, you know, and half the time she's wrong. You know, half the time she's not got it right, and she's for me. I know working in sort of pastoral stuff, she's crippled with anxiety. This girl, like she's I work with kids like this, you know, where they constantly obsessively think about what other people are saying and thinking of them, and they're half the time wrong. You know, so that really leaps out in the page, but it's very hard to translate. Really,
no, I mean to establish some common ground again between us, I think that. I think Lily James acquits herself better than Hammer does, in my opinion. I do think she's too old, which not that she looks old or anything, but I find it hard to buy her as like Mrs. Van Hopper's traveling companion. And I haven't really experienced anything yet. I plan to before I'm old again. I think some of the lines didn't seem right. But it's part of the problem, though, because of they've got this really physical side to the relationship which they establish. I find it a bit harder to see that character as someone who would then be so overwhelmed by Rebecca's presence. But I'm thinking about like when she says, was Rebecca very beautiful? I'm thinking, well, you're gorgeous too. You've apparently had quite a bit of hot sex with Maxim, so don't worry about it. I don't know. Do you think that's part of it?
It could be. It's weird because the book, I can't remember. I know I've just read it, so I should remember this. I can't remember if the book really characterizes what Mrs. De Winter looks like in terms of how beautiful she is or how pretty she is. I suspect not, given it's from her perspective, and it would be distorted anyway. So the film, in theory, would have the space to maybe cast somebody who isn't necessarily stunningly beautiful. I would say that Lily James pretty much is. Like, I'd say she's pretty gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they could have maybe cast someone in that role who isn't necessarily classically attractive. And it work a little bit better if you're particularly sort of trying to characterize Rebecca as just the most beautiful woman who ever lived. Because I think you're right there. I think that there is an issue with that, in that you kind of think, well, and again, that maybe that goes back to the fact that they've got one eye on trying to appeal to certain audiences. They've got one eye on trying to cast people who are popular with, I mean, you know, Armie Hammer's like got a massive, I think, Instagram following, you know, of particular fandoms. You know, Lily James, again, he's one of those actors who's, you know, I mean, recently there was all that tabloid stuff, wasn't there, about her? She was potentially having it away with Dominic West, and that was all very, you know, secret trysts and all this. I don't know if you saw that, but it was in...
I did.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to mention it, but...
Sorry, I'm much more salacious than you are. But, but, you know, that was something that came out around the point of Rebecca coming out as well, so that was interesting.
He'd have been a good Maxim De Winter.
Dominic, he would have been, actually. Yeah, I think absolutely. Yes, he definitely. He's the right age, isn't he? So there was a lot of almost like, you know, life imitating art to some extent, weirdly, there. But depending, I mean, who knows what the truth is? You know, it's probably not what the papers tell you. But you know, there's that whole thing of, they could have maybe been a bit more daring with the casting, maybe, even this. And that might have made for a more interesting, edgier movie.
I thought the filmmaker, it does try to suggest her ordeal in some nice ways. So like when Mrs. Danvers is showing around Manderley and they're like, the characters are really dwarfed in the frame with these enormous rooms, or when she meets Jack Favell and she's kind of hemmed in by the trees. But then the other thing that's interesting is it's much more trying to make the character more proactive, isn't it? So she's more proactive in like reviving the ball. She makes moves to dismiss Mrs. Danvers. She confronts Mrs. Danvers in front of her staff, doesn't she?
Yeah. She also, at the end, she's the one who goes into Dr. Baker's looking through the files, and that's none of that's in the book. So that's very
proactive. She's granted this level of agency, you know, and we get like this optimistic montage of her getting ready for the ball and that kind of thing. And I can understand why that might be an appealing approach, because I think a lot of filmmakers today are becoming a bit more aware, aren't they, of the need or of the positives of ensuring that women protagonists have more autonomy. And then the tension, though, is like Rebecca's a story that pivots on a woman who feels helpless. So I'm not sure it's the wisest choice, like artistically. So it's weird. Like to draw on the Hitchcock film as a point of comparison, there's that great scene, of course, where Mrs. Danvers is like kind of tempting her to jump from the window. You know, like, why don't you? Mm. And the equivalent scene here is still fairly effective. I don't think I ever... I think I felt like Joan Fontaine might jump. I'm not sure I felt like Lily James would, because I always thought she would kind of pull it back and, you know.
I think the Hitchcock one's the better film there in terms of how they do that. There was just something a little bit more relentlessly sort of Terminator-y, you know, about Danvers, jump, why don't you jump, like this. And you know what, I've always thought that the whole next sort of part of the book is such a plot device twist, in that ship suddenly crashes in the fog and oh, look what it finds, oh, there's the boat. And I, when I was reading it, I was like, oh, come on, this is one of those like massive, and in the Hitchcock film they condense it down, so it's played out slightly differently in the book. In the book, when Danvers confronts her, it's the following day after the ball. But in the film, the ball is happening. She runs upstairs, and then the boat crashes while the ball's going on. It doesn't quite happen like that in the book. I can't remember I think it's the same in the new film, in the Ben Wheatley from the book. I think Ben Wheatley's does it the day after or something like that. But it's And it shows you more of the ball, which the book itself does as well. And she has to go back down. And the Hitchcock film cuts all that out. But I do think that whole sudden, you know, and it's that boat crashing is what stops her from potentially jumping, you know, in theory, if she had jumped. And I just find that really hard to swallow as a plot device. It's just such a plot necessary thing to happen to get you into the final act. And it's the only thing in the book that I thought was just dodgy, basically, just out of nowhere. you know, and the reason I mention that is because when you get to that scene of that, you know, of Danvers trying to psychologically bully her into killing herself, it's like the book doesn't really know how to resolve that. In any of these stories, knows quite how to resolve that. How do you get her off that ledge? Oh, let's have a boat crash into the bay, you know, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? I just feel like it's difficult to sort of get the character to that point, and then where do you go from there?
I do know what you mean, and I think that's what I felt with the Hitchcock film. It's after that point, almost immediately, where I start to see some of the problems kind of mount up. Mm. So I know where you're coming from. Mm. Okay, so Kristin Scott Thomas as Mrs. Danvers here. I did enjoy her more. I think she was the standout. Like, I think she's got that
definitely
suitably icy demeanor. I think she has good fun, doesn't she, with lines like, no one wants you here. I've seen one or two reviews say that maybe it tips over into camp. I think it's a deliberate camp.
Mm.
I think she looked at the script and she worked out, okay, this is the way to play this character in the way they're doing this film, you know. And I think Wheatley had some fun with her too, you know. She's like the imposing way she's framed when we first see her meet Mrs. De Winter, the scene where she's watching her from above. Some of those, I always like it when she has these sudden appearances, you know.
I think it's more faithful to the book, actually. I think some of the choices he makes and the way that he structures some of these scenes is a bit more like the Danvers in the book for me.
Well, he's talked a bit about his sympathy for Danvers. I mean, what a lot of people have said with the Hitchcock film is this kind of this lesbian subtext with her like fondling Rebecca's clothes and that kind of thing. And Wheatley said he could see some inference of it in the book, but it wasn't something that, as part of modernizing it, he wanted to lean into. I mean, that could potentially be an interesting way to do it. You know, you could do a version of Rebecca that is radical along those lines, and you could yield some interesting results. But he also talked about his sympathy for her. Like, Danvers does things that are wrong, but I wanted to make sure that she was supported in the film so it doesn't have the black hat versus white hat morality to it. So he tries to flesh her out a bit, doesn't he? Like, you know, she talks about how she was Rebecca's friend and they have this bond that can't be broken. They have like a false truce for a while, don't they? And then, of course, there's the reveal that Danvers set her up and, you know, engineered the thing at the ball. I don't know. She's given some lines, though, where it's like, why shouldn't a woman amuse herself? No wonder a man had to kill her. I just found it a bit cringeworthy because, again, you sort of see the modern sensibility coming through in a way that's maybe a bit distracting. You know, he killed the only person I loved. It's too upfront for me if you're not actually going to go further with it. I don't know.
I suppose there's different ways to look at this. I mean, I felt like in this film that maybe she was much more of an incarnation of Rebecca, the character herself. It's like almost like Rebecca working through Danvers for me, more than in the Hitchcock film. Whether or not that's intentional or not, I don't know. But it felt like she was a lot more calculating and directly plotting in this.
Yeah.
In a way. And you know, I like the way she's dressed as well. She's dressed all in black, like in mourning, essentially. But there's almost a certain masculine aspect to the way she's dressed in this, I think. That's slightly different from the Danvers in the other book, in the other film, in that she's dressed a bit like a wraith. And I think she's like, I got the impression that that's part of what that was going on with this. The other thing that's very interesting in terms of the book, and I mentioned it sort of towards the beginning, is the idea that maybe Danvers is actually the only person who knows the objective truth about all this in the whole story. And that, I mean, I think Ben Wheatley said in another interview that, you know, audiences should have a big question mark hanging over their head as to quite what Rebecca was actually like in truth.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole idea that Max puts across that, you know, she was this vile, loathsome, you know, sociopathic sex maniac who he murders to get out of this horrible, toxic relationship is not necessarily true. That maybe he is not a good guy. And you know, I think, I don't really know if the film leaves you with that impression. You know, the film wants to leave you with this idea that they've conquered this, you know, this past and they've got this lovely life and they're going to be off and have this, you know, beautiful African adventure or whatever. Was there in Cairo, which is, again, I think, a nod to Du Maurier and her writing the book, because it's not in the novel.
Well, in the novel, it says at the beginning they're like moving from hotel to hotel, doesn't it? Before it flashes back, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it's probably a nod to that as well, isn't it? But they're not, But yeah, I like the idea that actually maybe Danvers actually does know the objective truth of this. And I wonder if there was some element that he wanted to lean into that, in that how she actually speaks at the inquest, and she doesn't in the book. She's in the gallery. So there's a little bit more of her being directly involved in trying to maybe tell her version of the truth, which might be objectively a bit more accurate, in that even though she's warped and she does think Rebecca is like, you know, because she's been with her since a child and she's obviously like deeply traumatized as a person. Yeah. But I don't necessarily come out of it thinking that Max is telling the truth, to be honest. Yeah. And, well, the story, I mean, the book. The film doesn't lead you down that path. I think unless you've read the book and you know the source material, I think the film wants you to believe more that Danvers is troubled and twisted and that these two should be happily ever after, you know?
Yeah. Although when he talks about being sympathetic, I think she still comes across as very malicious in the film. And of course, part of that's the ending. I think we need to touch on that because when I mentioned camp earlier, you know, so here we get Mrs. Danvers sets Manderley alight. So of course, in the book, it ends quite abruptly, doesn't it? And it's ambiguous about what actually happens. She sets Manderley alight. Then she jumps to her death from the cliffs in front of the second Mrs. De Winter. And she says, "You'll never know happiness." And she says, "Yes, I will." Lily James' character says, "Yes, I will." So
it's laid on a bit thick, isn't
it? Part of me likes the idea, though, of it, like this is her last action on Earth, and she's intent on traumatizing this woman for life, you know. But it is a bit much. Then the end, the very end. So you have her waking up in Cairo, the second Mrs. De Winter, from the dream. This story has been a dream, which is established at the outset, and it's kind of unspooling in her memory as she's unconscious. This morning I woke up and left the dead behind. So you're thinking, okay, maybe she's got over it. She's with Maxim. They're in Cairo. And then she has a bit of an affirmative speech, doesn't she? "I can see the woman I am now, and I know that I have made the right decision to save the one thing worth walking through flames for, love." So I know a few people have ridiculed that online. I don't think that tells the whole story, because actually the way it ends is a bit more ambivalent, because she gives this uncertain look to camera. What we hear the sound of waves crashing, and then we cut to the credits, which play out against this like watery blue backdrop. And we've seen the water motif throughout the film from the very start. So I personally think it's a bit ambivalent. I wouldn't necessarily read it as an empowering ending, which I think is good. I think it's good there's a bit of ambiguity.
Did you also wonder, and I have to say, much as the film by and large wants you to, you know, as I say, lead you into this happy ending, I did wonder if the look that Lily James gives to camera is suggestive that she is becoming Rebecca, or the idea of what we think Rebecca is, but, you know, throughout the film. You know, at the end, she's much more confident. Like you say, she, you know, she's saying this maybe slightly cheesy speech or whatever, but she's smoking, you know, which might be considered a sign of, you know, stronger sort of characteristics, certain individuality. And then, you know, there's this sultry sort of passionate embrace, but she looks to camera with a bit of a devilish look in her eyes. So I think that's intentional, in that maybe, I don't know, is that a little acknowledgement that either she hasn't really told the full story, the true story, or that she is transforming, you know, as maybe Rebecca did, because the book sort of tries to make you think that maybe Rebecca, that it started one way with Max and then it sort of twisted into something else that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you could read it in all kinds of different ways. And I think that's quite good, that it leaves you with a little bit of ambiguity, as you say. But I'd love to say that the whole film feels like that and that it's a consistent sort of thing all the way through. And I don't know if it is, really.
No, it's weird, isn't it? Because like the dream imagery comes and goes, doesn't it? It's a very well-made film. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I agree.
It didn't round all the bases for me, I don't think, you know. So I don't know. How would you, if you had to put a number on it, I would say probably like 3 stars out of 5.
Yeah, I think I'd say the same. I think I'd put a little bit of a tiny little write-up on Letterboxd and I gave it 3 out of 5. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, you know, there are aspects of it that, I think the way it looks is particularly nice. I think it's very well, like you say, it's very well made. I think some of the, you know, the production choices, I think, you know, the fact they filmed it in like about 3 or 4 different houses.
Yeah.
And I think Ben Wheatley's talked about how that he said you can't create Manderley in one location. It doesn't exist. It's too much of a blend of like Victoriana, Elizabethan, Tudor. It's all sort of mashed up together. And that's what he wanted to do with all these different locations. And I think that's good. I think he pulls that off quite well. As I say, I think, while you've given me pause on Armie Hammer, I think the casting is by and large really good. So I think there are lots of things that could in some ways tip it into a 3.5, but I think it's not consistent enough, and equally it's not as powerful enough or weird enough or twisted enough.
Yeah, that's my feeling basically. Yeah.
To warrant more than that. And I don't really think, I think visually it does the book justice. I don't think any film yet has truly done this film, done this book justice in terms of the power of what Du Maurier is writing. And I don't know if any will, because simply by virtue of the way she writes it. So, you know, I wait to be proven wrong on that.
Just before we go, let's have a look at how the film has gone down generally, because it's, you know, it's kind of fun to see what people have made of it, how they've compared it to Hitchcock and all that kind of thing. So in Vanity Fair, Richard Lawson said, Netflix's lifeless new Rebecca can't escape its precursor's shadow. And he says, I've no idea who this Rebecca is for. It's not for the purist who will scoff at all its bodlerizing of Du Maurier's fascinatingly ornate writing. And it's not likely to attract newer, younger fans, as was no doubt its intention. So what do you make about that? Do you think it is likely to attract many? I don't know how it's done on Netflix. It's hard to tell, isn't it? It's kind of opaque.
Yeah.
But do you see it attracting a lot of newer viewers?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, your fans of the actors will potentially show up. But I don't know. I just feel like maybe some of the period stuff might put some people off, to be honest. You know, maybe they might think it's a bit staid and a bit dull, you know, a story. It's hard to say. It's really hard to say, really. Maybe a bit of both.
Rachel Syme in The New Yorker said, when Netflix announced Wheatley as the new director of Rebecca in 2018, I imagined that he'd create something shocking or at the very least novel. What he ended up making instead is a film that lies somewhere between a lukewarm retread of Hitchcock's original and a glossy Instagram feed. So I definitely agree with her. Like, I never felt like shocked here by anything. I kind of wanted to lean into, like, do you remember when at the ball, when it kind of collapses into her dream and like everybody's going around chanting, Rebecca, Rebecca, Rebecca. Yeah. I've seen people say how like ludicrous that was, but maybe it should have aimed for that kind of weirdness more, or at least maybe that's what I was primed for, knowing it was a Ben Wheatley film, you know?
I think so. I don't think the Hitchcock thing is fair in that, like I say, I don't really think he's trying to remake it, Hitchcock's film. I think that's too easy to say, but I do think glossy Instagram feed's quite funny. there is a little bit of that, I think, to this in a way, I have to say.
It is quite different from the Hitchcock film, to be fair, I think. And I think there are lots of differences people will notice as they watch along, you know. So I think, I think you make a good point. Peter De Bruges in Variety made a good comparison, or an interesting comparison. He said, in both versions, so 1940 and 2020, the producers take a dominant hand, overriding some of the director's instincts. So, of course, referring to Selznick and Hitchcock in the first case. He says, here, it was the idea of the team at Working Title who gambled on unconventional talent to direct beloved literary properties in the past, which is how the world got Joe Wright's modern spin on Pride and Prejudice. He said they gambled on Wheatley for the project, but they've stopped short of where the Helmer's natural tendencies could have taken things. So I suppose that's interesting. Like, I suppose if you think of it as a Working Title product, it is a bit more kind of a piece with what you would expect, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it could be. I don't know if there were certain any restrictions from like the Du Maurier estate as well. I mean, I haven't heard anything about that or anything like that. You just don't know, do you really? I mean, they might be. I think they were just trying to. They were looking at it maybe from a perspective where they wanted something fairly safe. You know, they wanted something glossy, you know, overtly sort of sexy in a sense, you know, steamy, romantic, you know, on paper. But yeah, maybe if it was an original sort of script that Ben Wheatley and his, I think he writes with his wife, doesn't he? Amy Jump, I think.
I think this is a Jane Goldman script, isn't it? Yeah.
This is Jane Goldman. So, you know, I think had it been the kind of stuff that they've written together in the past and it was an original sort of plot, it might have been a lot more twisted. Maybe the certain things he felt like he couldn't do. I think, though, he just wanted to make a classical film. I think from what he said, he just wanted to make something along these lines, really. So maybe it has come from him.
Judging by the other projects he's lining up, like I said, it seems like maybe he's taking more of a mainstream turn. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. You know, there's a lot to be said for making a solid drama or a solid action film like Tomb Raider 2 or Giant Shark movie.
it could
be good. It could be good.
It could be.
Just finally, Stephanie Zakarek from Time magazine. So Wheatley overhandles and overworks the dough of Du Maurier's basic story. His movie is sometimes dumb, sometimes dull, and sometimes entertaining, just doesn't know what it wants to be, and that lack of vision drains its potential power. But she goes on to say, there's one problem that isn't his fault. Even Hitchcock's version loses some steam in the plot shift from shivery atmospherics to the requisite mechanics of explaining all the characters' secrets. So I do agree with that. You know, I think, like I said, I think that Hitchcock, as good as it is, loses it. You know, it's not as good for me in that final third or, you know, whatever it is. And I think this falls into some of the same traps, even though it does some different things in the final stages too.
I think, in a way, I think it's a flaw of the book more than anything else. You know, I think if they're adapting the book accurately, I think that third, that shift, as I mentioned before, it's jarring. It's jarring in the book, I think. And I think that it's just an issue with the story itself. And I don't know if any filmmaker's really going to resolve that unless they veer more from the source material.
Which you could easily do. I know we've seen things like I haven't seen it yet, but there's the is it Ratched on Netflix, which is like the one flew over the cuckoo's. No, but you can imagine a Rebecca miniseries that takes Rebecca Ryan as the Murphy main character does. Or something.
You could
give it time, especially if this one does well with the Netflix crowd. Yeah,
maybe. Anything's possible.
Well, it won't be long. It will happen again. We'll get another adaptation of this story somewhere, somehow. I'm sure we will.
Yeah,
film, television, whatever. So let's see what happens. All right, Tony. I'm really glad we could do this, actually. We could do this crossover as well. So thanks for that. And do you want to just let people know where you are online before we head off?
Yeah, you can check out my Twitter at AJBlackWriter. That's mainly where I am. And my website, which had a slight change of the name now. It's now culturalconversation.co.uk. It used to be ajblackwriter.com. But so you can find my stuff really on there.
Great. Cheers. And I am at CKJ Sweeney on Twitter. So if you're listening to this on Motion Pictures, remember, if you want to find the Movie Palace, it's at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter. If you're listening to this on the Movie Palace and you want to find Motion Pictures, it's at Motion Picks Pod. And yeah, hopefully there's some stuff in the back catalogues of both podcasts which might appeal to your interests. Hopefully,
fingers crossed.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network, and Ben Wheatley's adaptation of Rebecca is not all we're discussing. So we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed on the network in just a moment. So I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, because we were talking about this. We've talked about the different covers there are. Now, you, yourself, I thought I'd found a nice little sort of hidden gem here, because you yourself were in a band called Bleeder, or still are in a band called Bleeder.
Yeah.
And when I was looking on Spotify just for different covers of the song, I noticed there is a cover of this by a band called Bleeder. And I was like, oh, brilliant. This is what Niall's not told me, is that he's actually done a cover of it that got released.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Maybe I'm not coming at it from an educated point of view because, you know, not only am I a man, I'm gay. You know, I don't deal with pregnancy.
Are you?
And
I have you ever told us that before?
I was trying to make a serious point.
Hey, we love you. You know that.
Yeah, but you have got a good point, Colin. This is a bit of a sausage fest episode. Maybe we should have got a lady involved.
Real Asian podcast.
You know, so I really do feel that there's this, and whether it's an invisible weight on our shoulders to be able to be like this ideal child, or like, you know, just being able to not drag the family name down for whatever reason, even if it's self-imposed,
even if it's just completely made up in your mind.
Right, like you know, Brian, you were just saying about your friend who said they felt like they couldn't come out to you.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.